The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the final program for the week, The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the show, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, speaking of emails, on today's show, a little bit later, we'll be getting into quite a few that have come in over the past week, so you'll get to hear some feedback from some of your fellow listeners. And also, we'll be reviewing a pretty exciting section from Herbert Armstrong's autobiography that I think ties in with the one news item that I'll take you through here in just a second. And then also, we have another enjoyable segment on God's family culture that's coming up in the next segment. We actually found an opera that's based on a good story, or at least somewhat of a good story. And for more on that, you'll have to stay with us. I'll explain coming up a little bit later in today's show. Well, this first piece here from Stratfor, The Year That May Decide Europe's Fate. We have been talking about this even at the college, just thinking about what we're heading into this next year. We touched on it even at the last assembly we had, for the final assembly of the semester, in fact. What is ahead in 2017, given all of these things that are converging together, given all that's happened in this year, 2016? And we'll have more to say on that, too, as we get near to the end of our broadcasting for this calendar year. We'll do like we did last year and take you back over the past 12 months to just remind you of what has been happening, of all these prophetically significant events that have been unfolding. Well, what's ahead for 2017? As Stratfor points out here, by this time next year, the Eurozone could be defunct. I mean, this could happen in a matter of months. Stratfor says, despite the small chances of it actually happening, the fact that the collapse of the currency union is even possible speaks volumes about the size of the problems Europe faces. Some financial, economic, and political crises descended, since financial, economic, and political crises descended on the continent almost a decade ago, Europe has endured many difficult moments. It's been a rocky road for Europe. But now look at what it's facing. As Stratfor brings out, I mean, this upcoming year could be its most important, its most significant year, at least for the continuity of the Eurozone. It goes on to talk about, you know, all of the crises it's been facing already, but as it brings out, I mean, it's one thing to take on the financial misery of little Greece, or it's one thing to grapple with Brexit when Britain always had one foot out of the Union anyway. But when the crises start hitting the founding members, the most powerful states in the Union, when the crises start hitting Italy and France and Germany, well, that's something to sit up and take note of. It says here, next year, a series of events will put the European Union's foundational structures to the test. The bloc's most serious challenges will come from France and Italy, it says, it talks about some of the difficulties they're facing economically. And then the fact, too, that you have elections coming up in France in April and May, and then you have, as we've discussed this week, the resignation of the Italian Prime Minister and the elections that could lead to next year in Italy. Stratfor says France and Italy will see one of two scenarios unfold. In the first, the National Front and or the Five Star Movement, these two nationalist parties, they could see their rise to power bringing their respective countries even closer to leaving the Eurozone. To quit the currency area, the new governments would have to organize and win a referendum on the euro. Well, Stratford says that it looks like that's unlikely. I mean, they're gaining popularity, but it may be like in Austria that, you know, they don't yet quite have enough to win a majority. But it says here, in the second and more likely scenario, moderate parties in France and Italy stay in power. While this would diffuse the immediate crisis in the Eurozone, it may provide only a temporary respite. So even if the more moderate parties stay in, it's not going to solve the problems that run right to the core of Europe. And then it speaks about Germany's elections. I mean, Germany has an election too, but it's more toward the end of the year. And as Stratford brings out, by the time Germans head to the polls in September or October, I mean, events elsewhere, it says here, could have already triggered a Eurozone crisis. It's a good point to make. In other words, it's already, all of these events, all of these crises unfolding, and yet, what's going to happen in the next 10 months? What could happen in the next months before, the next few months running up to the German elections? Well, you know, we'll be following that closely here on KPCG and at thetrumpet.com. Stratford says here's Germany's initial reaction to a disintegrating Eurozone would be to find allies with which to collaborate on future trade and currency blocks. Now, we don't know for sure if the Eurozone's going to disintegrate, but we know things, as we've said so many times, we know things are going to be dramatically restructured. And it's interesting here that Stratford says, you know, when this collapse happens, if it does, if it disintegrates, Germany's initial reaction will be to find allies with which to collaborate, to find a currency block, to find allies to trade with, to find allies to join together with. So maybe it doesn't work, it's saying here, with 28. But what does the Bible say it will work with, at least for a short time? Even then, it's still a mixture of iron and clay. It says further, but this could prove difficult as well. Well, just trying to find these other partners, but it goes on to speculate on some of the nations that Germany might reach out to. Were the Eurozone to disintegrate. It says the real threat for Germany would not be the dissolution of the Eurozone, but the reintroduction of trade tariffs in Europe. The argument could be made that no matter what happens to the Eurozone, people will still want to buy German cars and will be willing to pay for them with Deutschmarks. But protectionist measures instituted, so here comes the trade wars as part of this story as well, but protectionist measures instituted in other countries would hurt German exports and lead to higher unemployment, while trade partners outside the European Union, such as the United States and China, could help mitigate the damage somewhat. They could not fully compensate for lower sales in Europe. And of course, what happens if there's bigger trade barriers with the United States? I mean, Stratford's giving giving a little too much credit to the oncoming administration, that there's going to be free trade with Europe and such. We've talked about that on a couple of programs, so I won't revisit it here. But it says it is no surprise, then, that the wave of anti-globalization sentiment sweeping across Europe and the United States is particularly concerning for Germany, a country that depends on globalization to thrive. Well, Stratford doesn't know that there are some dramatic changes coming for Germany too. We know this because of Bible prophecy, but it does hit on some pretty important points to keep our eyes on for sure. 2017, it's shaping up to be the most crucial year for European integration since all these crises began, Stratford says. And we can be thankful that we have prophecy as our guide. Bible prophecy, the sure word, God's truth. Because it says over in Revelation 17 that 10 kings are going to rise up in Europe. Will Europe's 10 kings come together in 2017? Well, if not, it surely can't be that much farther after or that much later. 10 kings, that's referring to the United States of Europe. We went through Revelation 17 recently, but to just reiterate, they're going to come together. It'll be a mixture of iron and clay. They'll have their differences. They'll have their squabbles. They'll have their internal fights. But the Bible also says they have one mind, and they give their power and strength to the beast. They're going to come together for a short time and join with this beast. Now, if you think about the keynote prophecy of Herbert Armstrong, the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, and the key components of that prophecy are that Germany would be the leader, would rise to dominate a united Europe. He also said that Britain wouldn't be a part of it. Well, that's already happened, or it's in the process of happening. And then he spoke of the spiritual binding force, the good graces of the Vatican offices, he often said. They're going to swoop in and lend a helping hand for this integration to happen. And then, of course, too, they need the confidence-inspiring leader. I mean, just think about that alone and the dramatic impact that the Daniel 8 man will have on Germany and all of Europe and even the Vatican. These are the days that we're coming into. It's pretty exciting to think about these prophecies being fulfilled. And yet at the same time, it's sobering. It's a time of trouble, as Daniel 12:1 says, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. A time of trouble like never before. Jesus said much the same in Matthew 24:21 and 22. We've got to get ready for this. If you go through and study all of Daniel 12, you can see, really, the countdown that's there. That's what we're on, a countdown. A countdown to the return of Jesus Christ. And we've got to be prepared and ready for what's ahead. Or my father said before, we've got to be emotionally prepared for these prophecies to be fulfilled. As I told the students on Wednesday, I mean, we've got to be getting ready personally for more growth in God's church, for God to amplify the message coming out from His church. For that to happen, we all have an individual role to play, and it's an important one, as I talked about on Monday's broadcast. And we got quite a few emails, by the way, in response to that one. How that God's work needs you. God's work has to be ready for what's coming, and you individually, you've got to be ready and prepared as well. In his autobiography, Mr. Armstrong, he told the story of the first time that he flew on an airplane, and he said he would never forget it, not just because of the fact that he's on a plane flying in the sky for the very first time in his life, but because of when it happened as well. He had left for Seattle on a Saturday night from Portland to Seattle. He got a train, an overnight train ride that arrived in Seattle the next morning, a Sunday morning at 7 or 8-ish, and I think he went on the air in Seattle at 8:30 in the morning. So, and it was a live broadcast back then. He had to go to all these different radio stations for the most part. There was the network, I think, between Portland and Salem and Eugene, but it wasn't really reliable. and the signal faded in and out and so on. But with a lot of them, he had to be there at the station to actually give the broadcast. And so he'd show up in Seattle, he'd get the Sunday morning newspaper, he'd flip through the headlines, he'd read some of the key stories, and then he'd get right into it as soon as 8:30 hit. Well, once that was over, then instead of taking the train back, he flew in the first airplane he had ever been in. And that was supposed to get him back to Portland in the early afternoon so that he could give his broadcast there again live in Portland. I think it started at 4 p.m. So it was a busy day. And as he said in the autobiography, he would never forget that first flight, because after the plane took off, about 15 minutes into the flight, he noticed one of the captains that was going through the cabin and whispering something to each of the passengers. And when he finally got to Mr. Armstrong, he told him in a very quiet and calm voice, and yet one that was deeply concerned, he told him that the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor that morning while they were en route to Portland. And Mr. Armstrong, on his way to a broadcast, a live broadcast, he knew that this meant war. He knew now that the United States had been drawn into World War II. This was a world war. He says here in his autobiography, you can find this on page 561, I believe it is, in the newly printed version that we give away for free. Some 900 and some odd pages. It's a beautiful book. He writes, "Arriving in Portland, I jumped into a cab and got to the radio studio as quickly as possible. I purchased the extra newspapers being sold on the streets." This is on December 7th, 1941. "I carefully scanned the teletapes of latest news at the radio station. Out came my portable typewriter. A new broadcast was dashed off. At 4 p.m., I went on the air with one of the red-hottest broadcasts of my life. He was on fire. This was one of the red-hottest broadcasts of his life," he said. He writes, "I knew that all of my listeners probably knew already of the Pearl Harbor Day of Infamy. I merely reported the very latest few items of news and then went into an explanation of the meaning of it. In biblical prophecy." He says, "This was one of the exciting incidents of my life." What a rush it must have been. And what an impact it had on his broadcasting ministry. He went on and said, "From that point on, my broadcast took on more and more the nature of news analysis of the war. Listener interest increased now that the United States was in a war." Well, how about that? The nation was in the midst of a great trial, and people started to perk up and take interest in what God's servant had to say. And God, of course, had prepared him for this moment. He had been preparing him for this for years, even before his conversion. Mr. Armstrong says, "It was now more than ever that my 20 years' experience in the newspaper and magazine field profited the work. Not only did I have long experience in recognizing significant news and in processes of analysis of news as well as of business and merchandising conditions, but now with a 14-year accumulation of biblical knowledge and understanding of prophecies, resulting from these years of intense and concentrated as well as consecrated study, I was able to produce radio programs that carried even greater public interest than those of the network news analysts." And he goes on to say that news analysis, those were the most popular programs back in the 1940s. And he mentioned some of the most popular hosts. We've talked before about Edward R. Murrow. But Eric Severide, he lists them off in his autobiography. Elmer Davis, Raymond Grand Swing, and then, as I say, Edward Murrow. These were some of the most popular commentators of the day. And yet, all of those men, as Mr. Armstrong says in his autobiography, all of them knew nothing about Bible prophecy. None of them understood the real purpose that God's working out here below. None of them could grasp the significance of world events. They couldn't grasp the significance of the events they were reporting on, the events they were supposedly analyzing. And they certainly didn't know where it was all leading. Now, God, of course, even with Mr. Armstrong, was opening his mind to understand during that Second World War that there would indeed be another recess between that war and then the next World War, just like there had been between the Great War and World War II. He came to understand, Mr. Armstrong did, that he was living through the sixth head, the sixth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. But even as the war was breaking out, he certainly understood that we were living in the last days, that we were getting that much closer to the return of Jesus Christ. So he talked about the advantage he had over the news commentators of the day. And then there was a growing number of ministries on the air as well. And he writes here, on the other hand, none of the ministers broadcasting religious programs had the newspaper and analytical background, nor, I may add, the true understanding of the prophecies to connect that entire third of the Bible with the war events. He says, finally, putting the two together, factual knowledge and analysis of war events with biblical prophecies put at my disposal a powerful, interest-compelling message. And he says, finally, radio station managers recognize this. And so this was the beginning of a long broadcasting career. And at the point of this attack, December 7th, 1941, he was just basically limited to those small stations in the Northwest, the Great Northwest, Oregon and Washington, Seattle, Portland, Eugene, and Salem. But in that same chapter of the autobiography, this comes from chapter 42, you can read about the door opening for him to go to Los Angeles. He also talks about a visit to a powerful station in Des Moines, Iowa, that he would go on soon after. And the work during those war years really did explode with growth. Now, there is a difference with respect to that time period and the time period of Daniel 12 and verse 1, which I read to you a moment ago. And it's the fact that Daniel says at that time of trouble, like this world has never seen, God is going to deliver his people. God is going to protect his people. And we know, too, about a famine of the word that is prophesied in the book of Amos, Amos 8. But still, I think an important point that we can take away from this history is as we see or draw closer to the outer edges of this troublesome time, who else out there has the truth? Are people going to be able to go to the most popular commentators of today and receive the truth? Are they going to know the significance of these events being analyzed if they're reading the New York Times or watching CNN or Fox News or listening to their favorite radio personality, talk radio? And then what about the religious speakers, the televangelists? Well, they don't really get into world events. Some of them meddle in politics. They can get behind Donald Trump. But do they know the significance of events as they unfold in the heart of Europe? And furthermore, do they understand Bible prophecy? It's a third of the Bible. It's a third of your Bible. God's going to draw some serious attention to his work, his church. And as my father's made the point to us in editorial and over the years, I mean, he's made the point several times that as times get worse, people are going to take note of what God's work is doing and saying. Ezekiel 33 brings this out. I won't take the time to go over there, but to just refer you back to this most, one of the most exciting incidents of Mr. Armstrong's life. It was right in the midst of that worldwide war, that public interest in the World Tomorrow radio program, public interest in the truth of God, it really did intensify. And you can certainly see why. Even station managers could recognize that this program Mr. Armstrong was giving was different. It was different than the news commentators of his day. It was different than the other religious speakers of his day. He had at his disposal a powerful, interest-compelling message. And so do we, as we continue following in those same steps, carrying on with God's work in these latter days. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, as several others have done this past week, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
A couple of days ago I felt pretty good about myself when I received this in the mail. Didn't even know it was coming, but it's the Spring 2017 catalog from the Royal Opera House in London. So I felt in my heart all the more cultured on Wednesday morning when this catalog came in the mail. Some interesting, and it seems like, some, I don't know a lot about these operas that are, well, I actually do know a lot about one of them, The Elixir of Love. That's the opera that I saw in Vienna in June, so that's coming to London. But the one that did catch my eye was Giuseppe Verdi's Don Carlo. And if you know anything about this particular opera, you'll have to email the program and let me know if you've seen it or if you've read a little bit about it. I only had a chance just before the program to track down a summary online. The catalog itself says it's a great portrayal of the epic sweep of history and the lives and ambitions it crushes in its path. So that's by Verdi. And in looking at the schedule, they do have one. It's a 4.5-hour marathon, a 4.5-hour opera. I don't know if the children would stay with me through to the end of it, but we'll see if I get a chance. It's coming here next May. It's a long ways off, but I'll certainly keep my eye on it as we move through the exciting events of 2017. That's coming up to London in a few months. This first email here ties in. It says here, enjoy the program so much from your radio broadcast from Edstone. Thanks for the great biblical information you give us each day. I learn so much from the show, your dedication in doing God's work along with your loyal staff. It says, I really enjoy the music you play from the various operas that you've attended with your family. Thank you so much for doing that. Yes, all of us need to be more cultured when it comes to great music from live opera plays. It seems like the Europeans are way ahead of us Americans in that area. Well, this particular listener, he's the one that sent me this recommendation, also from Giuseppe Verdi. It's his other opera titled Nabucco, and this is, I guess that's how you pronounce it, but it's loosely based on the story about the conquest of the Jews by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. So as I said at the top of the show, I mean, here's a story where, well, it actually could be somewhat decent. When the opera opens, the Jews are they're about to be defeated by the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar and his army are barreling down on Jerusalem. And Nabucco, I guess, is the Italian version of Nebuchadnezzar. So there's an opera titled Nebuchadnezzar. This is the summary from a website I located this morning. It says, the high priest of Zechariah asks his chosen people to trust in God. In the meantime, Phenina, Nabucco's younger daughter, who's being held hostage by the Jews, is in love with her jailer, Ismael, who was once saved by Phenina when he himself was being held hostage by the Babylonians. And then it goes on to talk about the romance and so on. I said it was loosely based on the story about the conquest of the Jews by the Babylonians. In any event, this listener that sent in this recommendation, he directed me to one selection from Nabucco in particular. And this one that you're about to hear comes from Act 3, and it's titled The Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves. Enjoy.
Thank you.
chorus of the Hebrew slaves from Verdi's Nabucco, or Nabucco. Don't know too much about that particular opera, or I didn't until one of you sent me the suggestion to play this one and to learn a little bit more about that that story. Hopefully you're able to turn up the volume. Remember, that's the encouragement I typically give when we play wonderful tunes like that, and I think some of you probably recognize the melody there from that chorus. A few more emails. One here that warms your heart. I'm almost 10 years old and from Buffalo, New York. Thank you for teaching me about God and putting God first. Almost 10 means that listener is, I guess, 9. But I guess I'm wondering if I believe it was a he, is if he's younger than the gal who wrote back in October. I believe she was 8 or 9. I think the record for an email coming in from the youngest listener, it has to be 8 or 9. So maybe there's some even younger than that. If so, send me a message through your parents' email account. I'd love to hear from you. 10 years old and appreciating learning about putting God first. This one here in response to yesterday's show on Aleppo, it says the surreal red lines drawn by the U.S. did nothing to contain the cruelty of Assad, but rather served only to trap the very people who would escape this cruelty within the weakness of our caving in on the Syrian people, as now the real red lines draw round about Aleppo are with the blood of its inhabitants. The soles of the boots of Putin's power do collect in their treads the bloody clods issued from the trampled, injured, and dead. That comes from one of our more articulate listeners who typically gives some very thorough feedback to every program. This one here from Arkansas says, I'm trying to catch up with the programs. I am so appreciative of the fact that you are marking this history and recording the facts and the truth about this president's legacy. That's in response to the Obama Doctrine, the program we had last Friday, where we did look back on that legacy, going back to when he won the Nobel Peace Prize in the first year of his presidency in 2009. Another one in response to that show says, it's quite inspiring to see the daily work become more bold and effective. The opening montage was penetrating and stirring. Great work putting that together. What an emotional impact. I can appreciate your criticism about religious leaders rarely quoting the Bible. This world is so unholy. If you even begin to mention God or the Bible, people instantly jerk their head and just mentally disconnect. They don't want to hear anything about God or the Bible. And yet that's the only stuff worth talking about. Another one here, following the Obama Doctrine. I listened to your program on Friday, and I must say, it was an excellent show. You were so right about how prophecy is moving swiftly along to fulfillment. Thank God and you and your staff for your tireless efforts for bringing the rest of us the priceless truths of God's Word. You all make it so easy to understand, and you help to give hope in a sad and hopeless world. Thanks so very much, and God bless you all. Quite a few, as I said earlier, that came in response to Monday's program on God's work needs you. This one here says, God did not make us to be idle beings, but his helpers, and to be helpers of helpers. God would have us join as one in spirit to support the work. And this is what is more powerful and rich than any gold, as of course spirit does pre-exist any kind of material wealth, and no physical wealth can purchase this spirit. And for doing this great work, the truth and knowing God is the greatest reward. Another one here from Suriname. It says, wow, and another classic TD episode on coworkers. This is again in response to Monday's show. A very encouraging one at that. I was thinking of responding to the anniversary episode, but somehow I kept putting it off. But this TD compelled a reaction. As I'm going through the autobiography, I can't help but to be ever grateful to the Father for using Mr. Armstrong, his willingness to go through all that he went through to be an instrument of God's during the Sixth Era. It says it's so inspiring to hear you pulling examples and stories out of that history to strengthen the work of God today. Another one here, following Monday's show. What an encouraging program. We've been placed in this work just where God wants us, to learn how to be assistants now in the body and in the body of the work of Christ, so when Christ returns, we can become his helpmeet forever. It's beautiful. I really needed to hear this program as never before. Another one here from a mother in New Zealand. Just listen to your latest program highlighting the need for all of us to help wholeheartedly in God's work. At the recent feast, we heard a message prompting us to think about what we'd like our future title to be in God's kingdom. I thought of mine right away, an expression my mom taught me growing up. I want to be Girl Friday, which means a go-to girl who will help you get things taken care of, who you can rely on when you are in need of extra assistance. I told my mom about this after the message, and she said, good, now you just need to become Girl Sunday, Girl Monday, and so on. So she's given me an even higher goal to achieve, that from New Zealand. Another one here from Florida. It says, this was such an uplifting and inspiring program for me personally. The way God worked in my life in calling me out of this world to become a co-worker and now a member of his true church. It was definitely a miracle when one day I received a book in the mail with the title The God Family Vision. I had no affiliation with the WCG or PCG prior to receiving this book, but it was addressed to me. I truly believe this was the beginning stages of God calling me into his work. Every member and co-worker has a vital role from the top on down in finishing this great work of God. Keep up the great work via radio. Let's push forward as one unified body of Christ and finish this great work. Thanks for your dedicated service. Well, this last one here is one that I passed along to our students on Wednesday. It comes from a listener named Steve Herkus. He's actually teaching a class at God's College on the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong. So he's getting to know that history quite well. And he says here, I really appreciate the recent examples that you've used from Mr. Armstrong's autobiography. Studying that book again, along with the Bible, of course, has been one of the most invigorating studies of my life. This book is chock full of counsel. It's a wonderful example of learning to surrender to God, and it's a wonderful account of our history. Subsequently, through this study, Mr. Armstrong has become a close personal friend. So every time you quote from this book, I hope listeners are compelled to dig into the autobiography and share a friendship with Herbert Armstrong as well. Some nice encouragement to finish off with. If you don't have a copy of the autobiography, what are you waiting for? You can contact that. You can send an email to the TD address, and I'll forward it to the mail processing center if you like. But if you know how to contact the church directly, if you know how to contact headquarters in Edmond, get that autobiography book and dig into it and really develop that close personal friendship with Herbert Armstrong and, of course, with the great being that was guiding him, the Creator God. Well, I'm going to close off a few minutes early, but I'm going to close off with another treat. I've got a video to tape here, and we are getting close to sunset. I'm running out of time in this day here at Edstone, so I'm going to move on to the next project. But as I do, I'm going to leave you with another selection from an opera called Rodelinda. I don't know anything about this one except that it's by Handel. It was, written... The story takes place in the 17th century. I think it was written, excuse my musical ignorance, but it was after that sometime, just to be completely generic in general. In any event, it's one that I heard When I was tracking down the Hebrew chorus this morning, this one came on right after I found that chorus of the Hebrews, and it's just another beautiful selection. It goes, I think, for about 6 minutes. So we'll conclude with the music and then the close to the program. But before I get to the opera, don't forget about your weekend assignment. We're on the last show of the week, and it's important for us to hear from you over these next couple of days. And let us know what you think about the program in general, or what you think about one of the specific shows that we put together, or what recommendations you have as far as opera selections or classical selections that we can play from time to time. Or you can email me if you want to tell me a little bit about Don Carlo, so I can continue my research before that shows up in London in May. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
The Trumpet Daily.